This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia, episode 131, Breaking Babylon. You'll probably notice that today's episode is a bit shorter than sometimes. As a writer, you occasionally get too perfect an ending to pass up, and this is just one of those days. Last time, we covered the Third War of the Diadochoi, as Antigonus Monophthalmos made his bid for power after seizing control of almost all of Alexander the Great's old empire. The Antigonid realm suddenly spanned across almost all of West Asia, bringing the ambitious Strategos of the East to blows with his three Western counterparts, Ptolemy of Egypt, Lysimachus of Thrace, and Cassander of Macedon, acting on behalf of the child king Alexander IV. The war was messy and chaotic, with battle lines shifting back and forth across Greece and southern Anatolia. Antigonus attempted to ally with the Odrysian Thracian kingdom in a failed invasion of Lysimachus's territory. Ptolemy successfully defeated Antigonus's 20-year-old son Demetrius, only for Demetrius to successfully counterattack a year later. And Antigonus's return to southern Syria forced Ptolemy and the rest of the Western allies to sue for peace, resetting the balance of power to the status quo antebellum, with one exception. The cities of Greece were granted more autonomy than they had seen in decades. However, while the Big Four fought in the West, Ptolemy equipped Seleucus with 1,000 men to head east and reclaim his own satrapy in Babylonia. They set out at the beginning of spring 311 BC, effectively trying to cut Antigonus's territory in half. Even as Seleucus went east, Antigonus and Demetrius were sucked into a separate war against the Nabatean Arabs, which gave Seleucus valuable time to act unimpeded. As the first order of business, Seleucus supposedly slipped behind enemy lines and sailed with a few trusted companions to visit the oracle of Apollo at Didyma, near the city of Miletus, in order to seek some divine guidance. According to the man himself, the oracle foretold great success and cast a comparison to Alexander the Great. Seleucus used these claims to bolster morale in his little Seleucid army as they marched from Tyre to the Euphrates River, crossing near Carhi. Since the initial Macedonian conquest, Carrhae had become a military colony of the new imperial overlords, and Seleucus convinced the garrison of the city to join him on the campaign. With these reinforcements, he marched down the eastern bank of the Euphrates, following in the footsteps of those like Alexander the Great and Cyrus the Younger before him, recruiting more soldiers as he went. After several years of neglect from Antigonus, many people in Mesopotamia were eager to have an influential leader focused on them once again, and Seleucus had 4 years as an effective and even-handed governor to bolster his local reputation. Even the main Antigonid garrison left to guard Babylon itself went over to his side. During this journey, they encountered a single fort where the small number of remaining Antigonid loyalists had gathered in order to make a stand for the province. Rather than besieging the defenses, the small Seleucid army took it by storm, overwhelming the defenders in a single push, not only scoring an early victory to boost morale, but retaking the friends and family of Seleucus, who had been held hostage by Antigonus after the satrap fled from Babylon in the first place. The surviving Antigonid officers were taken prisoner, but their soldiers were incorporated into the ever-growing Seleucid host as they approached the city of Babylon itself. They arrived near the end of May 311 BC and immediately ordered the local scribes to start dating their records according to the reign of King Alexander IV and his general Seleucus, rather than continuing to use Antigonus's year as reigning general in official documents. We know this thanks to Chronicle 10 from the Babylonians' own chronicle tablets. Tablet 10 is damaged almost beyond legibility, since we only have most of one of the original four columns, but the bits that are preserved describe an interesting battle, or maybe a pair of battles that the Western sources leave out, as Seleucus secured the area around the capital. Just after taking Babylon, Seleucus marched north to the city of Cutha, and sought support from the priesthood at the Temple of Nergal, a Mesopotamian underworld god associated with warfare. The section that would explain how those meetings actually went is damaged, but it picks up with Seleucus besieging and failing to take the citadel of another city somewhere north of Babylon. This siege apparently lasted for a full month before something very interesting happened. Quote, Seleucus, in order to capture the palace to somewhere, it's illegible, went. The defenses with water like a deluge he leveled, and he did not dam the Euphrates. So it's kind of odd that this tablet would specify that Seleucus didn't build a dam. Most historians interpret this as he did build a dam, cutting off the water from the fort they were attacking, and then Seleucus's troops tore that same dam down, letting the water surge forward all at once, flooding the fort and forcing the defenders to surrender. Back in the Greek sources, Nicanor, Antigonus's chosen satrap of Media, summoned the armies of western Iran to mount a defense of Antigonid territory, gathering over 17,000 soldiers. This is probably the closest to a classic Greek versus Persian confrontation we've seen or will see for a long time. Though Seleucus's army was just 3,000 infantry and 400 horsemen, they were largely Macedonian-style phalangites and hetairoi lancers. Meanwhile, Nicanor commanded 10,000 mostly light infantry and 7,000 horse archers and javelin throwers in the traditional Iranian style. Rather than proceeding to Babylon, Seleucus crossed the Tigris north of modern Baghdad and hid out in some nearby marshes to avoid Nicanor's scouts. The trick worked. When Nicanor's army marched out of the Zagros Mountains and couldn't find the invasion force, they assumed that Seleucus was still somewhere in the west, and made camp along the royal road, Seleucus' small army marched out of the swamps and swarmed the camp, specifically targeting the officers' tents to kill the leaders of Nicanor's army and prevent them from organizing the defense. Between the confusion and popular discontent with Antigonid rule, many of Nicanor's troops just surrendered and joined Seleucus outright. Nicanor himself fled northwest into the Assyrian desert with his closest followers, and the remaining officers from Media, Susiana, and Persia pledged themselves, their armies, and their satrapies to Seleucus. With barely a fight, Seleucus had nearly quadrupled his strength and gained control of the four core provinces of the old Persian Empire. But this had all happened while Antigonus himself was busy fighting a war with the Arabs. He tried to put his son in charge of negotiating an end to that conflict, but felt that Demetrius gave the Nabataeans too much leeway in their peace settlement. And sure enough, Arab raiders started crossing the Dead Sea and plundering Judea, just as word reached Antigonus that Nicanor had been defeated. Very frustrated, Antigonus encamped near the southern end of the Dead Sea and ordered Demetrius to take 15,000 infantry and 4,000 cavalry east. Their hope was that they could catch Seleucus unprepared and crush him in a swift attack. And we will see how their hopes panned out after a quick break. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. We are back. Demetrius is marching east with a large portion of the Antigonid army while his father deals with ending the war against the Nabataean Arabs, and Seleucus is awaiting a response in Babylon. Rather than becoming a sitting duck, Seleucus was moving much faster than Antigonus could possibly have predicted. Almost as soon as Nicanor was defeated and he had secured Babylon, Seleucus left one of his own subordinates, Patrocles, in charge of the city and took most of his army north to Media, seizing control of Ecbatana before winter set in. Then, in spring of 310, Seleucus marched east to seize control of the upper satrapies, and was, by extension, very far away from Babylon when Demetrius arrived. Knowing that he didn't have the strength to hold the city, Patrocles ordered a massive evacuation, emptying the most populous city of the ancient world almost entirely, and only maintaining a few of the defensive fortifications. The point wasn't actually to defeat Demetrius, just slow him down long enough for Seleucus to get back. The Antigonid army did defeat Patrocles' token resistance, and for the first time in over 300 years, an invading army sacked Babylon, plundering its palaces and temples. However, with Seleucus nowhere in sight and the Babylonian people safely hiding out in the surrounding countryside, there wasn't much for Demetrius to do. So he marched north and left a small occupation force of 6,000 men behind, taking the rest back toward the Mediterranean. Here we return to an old problem, but it is a problem that really solidifies Seleucus's place in the pantheon of ancient West Asian rulers. Despite its overall significance, involving some of the most prominent figures of the ancient Greek world, the likes of Plutarch and Diodorus don't bother to cover the next phase of the Babylonian War. We are once again, if only briefly, in the territory of events covered by barely legible clay tablets. Seleucus took his sweet time in making sure all of the upper satrapies were firmly under his control before coming back to Babylon. By leaving the city with such a small occupation force, Demetrius gave Seleucus the perfect opportunity. He simply besieged the remaining Antigonid forces and proclaimed that brittle resistance proof that Antigonus didn't seriously intend to continue governing the region. This worked quite well, because Seleucus's return was very well received in Babylon before returning to his campaigns in the east for a few more months. After achieving a more decisive victory in his Nabatean War, Antigonus himself turned his army northeast and crossed the Euphrates in August of 310 to try and retake Babylon for himself. Seleucus's forces were still skirmishing with the remains of the garrison Demetrius had left behind, and Antigonus was able to break through Babylon's immediate defenses and ransack part of the inner city. The Seleucid defenders held him off in street-to-street fighting with spear and sword, and the city was split in two for months as they fought intermittently house-to-house, building-to-building. In early March of 309, Seleucus started making his way back to Babylon once again, and Antigonus decided to withdraw from the capital. He went north, plundering the Mesopotamian countryside and sacking Cutha instead. He burned down the Temple of Nergal in the process before going back to rural plundering, stealing as many horses as possible to beef up his own cavalry. And I guess that answers the question of how Seleucus's negotiations with the priesthood went. If Antigonus thought it was worth his time to go and sack their temple specifically. Trying to draw Antigonus into a direct confrontation, Seleucus occupied the city of Borsippa, but Antigonus just kept plundering the farmland. Chronicle 10 makes a point to note that Antigonus's campaign was immensely destructive. Crops were destroyed and looted, and since everyone had to flee from the invading army's path, they weren't able to recultivate the land quickly either. The cost of staple goods like barley and wheat skyrocketed. Finally, Seleucus went back to Babylon to raise a larger army before marching to Antigonus in early August of 309. The war had become too destructive for Seleucus to allow it to continue, so he had to face the invaders on whatever battlefield he could find. It just so happened to be along the royal road southeast of Babylon. The two armies encamped near one another, but Seleucus ordered his men to stay in their full armor and sleep out in the open in battle formation rather than breaking out into actual tents to sleep comfortably. They may not have been well rested when the sun rose, but the Seleucid formation just had to stand up, rub their eyes, and lift their spears. They marched into the Antigonid camp at the break of dawn, surprising the enemy and forcing Antigonus to retreat. Now, with his forces exhausted, Antigonus returned to western Syria. He may have intended to recuperate and try to take Babylon again at some point, but there were other pressing concerns. Ptolemy had fully subjugated Cyprus once again and started besieging Halicarnassus in Caria. Both he and Cassander had actually started small wars against individual Greek cities. After all, under the terms of the peace agreement, all of those little poleis were independent states and could be fought on their own terms if there was a dispute. Never mind that places like Halicarnassus were Antigonus's vassals in all but name. Demetrius did take an army to drive out Ptolemy, but it was clear that tensions were heating up in the west once again. More importantly, though, by the time Antigonus returned from Mesopotamia, people had started breaking the rules. Really, the one singular rule that had kept all these former friends and companions of Alexander the Great together since the Lord of all Asia's death. They were all fighting for power beneath King Alexander IV, son of Alexander, child patriarch of the Ogygiad House, a dynasty of Macedonian kingship that traced its roots back to the hazy era of mythology before recorded history. Polyperchon seems to have tested that boundary first. He went to the city of Pergamon in northwestern Anatolia, where he found a young man called Heracles. Supposedly, this was the illegitimate son of Alexander the Great and the Persian noblewoman Barsine, whose claim to kingship was first suggested by Nearchus, way back in 323, just after Alexander's death. He had been ignored since then, and as I've said before, the timeline of his birth doesn't actually align with the point where Alex and Barsine spent any time together. Some historians have even speculated that Polyperchon just grabbed some teenager who looked like he could be related to Alexander and proclaimed him the long-forgotten Heracles. Maybe Heracles was the real deal. Maybe Barsine lied about his father. Maybe Polyperchon made up the whole thing. It doesn't really matter because Polyperchon, in a last-ditch effort to reclaim power from Cassander, started proclaiming this kid to be the rightful king. Cassander one-upped that by firmly, definitively, breaking the only rule that held the Macedonian Empire together on paper. Ptolemy, Lysimachus, Antigonus, and Cassander had all been testing one another's boundaries for years, completely ignoring the fact that they were, hypothetically, all servants of the same boy king. And by 309, Alexander IV was 14 years old. That's still a few years shy of Macedonian adulthood, but only 2 years away from the age his famous father had first led men into battle. And plenty old enough to start questioning why all of his subordinates kept starting civil wars. Cassander, who was technically the regent in charge of stewarding the kingdom through Alexander's minority and making wise policy decisions that would set up the young monarch for success, came to three conclusions. First, none of the other major governors were likely to just lay down their arms and behave when Alex turned 18. Second, Alexander might have different opinions from Cassander and would drain support from the regent within Macedon and Greece as he neared adulthood. Third, Cassander himself quite liked being the ultimate authority in his homeland. So, he passed orders to Glaucius, commander of the guard in the royal palace where Alexander IV and his mother Roxane were living. Those orders were to kill the king and his mother, then quietly dispose of the bodies without anybody at court noticing before Cassander could fabricate some lie about what had really happened. Then, Cassander warned Polyperchon that he would be next if he kept pushing Heracles' cause, and before anybody quite realized what was happening, Heracles, Roxane, and Alexander IV all came down with a fatal case of poison in their wine. Alexander IV, son of Alexander the Great, was just 14 years old and had been the king of Macedon for his entire life. For the first 6 years, he had shared the throne with his uncle, Philip Aridaeus, and for the last 8, he had technically been the sole ruler of the Macedonian Empire. The Agiad dynasty had ruled Macedon for 500 years, according to their own histories, and has held that position since we first met them in episode 24 of this podcast. In the summer of 309 BCE, that all came to an end. Macedon was left a kingdom without a king, and with no throne to pledge allegiance to, the 5 great rulers of Alexander the Great's sprawling empire became satraps without a shah. Cassander the Antipatrid, Antigonus Monophthalmos, Lysimachus of Thrace, Ptolemy of Egypt, and Seleucus of Babylon were now free agents. You might expect this to lead to an immediate outbreak of war between this pentad of warlords. Maybe an outcry of injustice and treason as the other 4 rallied against Cassander. But no. They all knew it was coming. But for almost a year, each of these major factions held their breath and continued to consolidate power just as they had since the end of the last war. As Diodorus puts it, they all were relieved from the expected danger from the king, for henceforth, there no longer being anyone to inherit the kingdom, each of those who had authority over nations or cities entertained hopes of royal power and held territory that had been placed under their authority as if it were a kingdom won by the spear. Or, to put that another way, they were finally free to live up to their late great king's final words, to the strongest.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.